All right, Erev Tov, everybody. Hope everybody's well. Want to welcome you, and it's a pleasure to welcome him for his inaugural talk at Torah in Motion, Rabbi Wes Kalmar, who is the rabbi at Anshei Sfar Kehila Torah in Milwaukee for the past 13 years, bar mitzvah year. And I really want to thank him. We were together last week in Miami Beach, the learning program, the Yarchei Kal. I think I mentioned with, you know, Rabbi J.J. Schechter. And so I picked up a few extra people to give more shiurim. So I really want to thank him and welcome him, a graduate of Yeshiva University, Reitz, Revel, the program in Jewish Studies. He's a member of the Executive Board of the Rabbinical Council of America and the co-editor of Torat Chaim, Words to Share at Life's Meaningful Moments. That's the book they gave out last week, a really very, very beautiful, powerful book on all of life cycles events. So it's a pleasure to welcome him. Learning today is being sponsored in honor of Tzvi Fruchter's 78th birthday with love from his brother Chaim. And may be blessed with good health. May have asked you. I don't know if Chaim's on yet, but hopefully, please God, he'll come. And thank you very much, Rabbi Kalmar. It's all yours.
Thank you very much. I'm here. Oh,
there you are. There you are. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank very you. Good.
Thanks. Okay, should be for good memory. All right. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kalman. We go back a long way in terms of these Yarchei Kal. It's been 20 years already going to these Yarchei Kal with Rabbi Schechter. So a really honored to be here at Torah in Motion. It's known around the world for the Torah that you share, and the classes and the Divrei Torah, and putting out just always sort of on the cutting edge. And it's really been Marbit's Torah. You've spread a lot of Torah around the world with this program and with this this whole learning concept. And it's really been amazing. So Yasher Koach to you. And I'm really, really very honored to be here and to share with everybody. Okay. I hope everybody can see, the PowerPoint. So unpacking the golden calf story, are we still worshiping it? I think that, you know, we tend to think about this story, as we do about many stories in Tanakh, in the Bible, some sort of a early childish sort of approach. Oftentimes we think about, we learn stories perhaps when we're children, and sometimes we advance and we develop our thought about a story or about a narrative in the Bible at a later age. And sometimes we don't so much. Sometimes we still think of it in a very sort of basic form. And I think that the golden calf story is one of those. It's one that we really have a hard time relating to. We sort of think of, you know, the Jews, they came out and all of a sudden they're dancing around this golden calf, and boy, were they bad and, you know, evil and hard to imagine. Like, what were they doing? And we don't really have a handle on what exactly was going on there. So I'm hoping that tonight, perhaps we will see two or maybe even three sort of new or different or perspectives or approaches as to what exactly happened here with this story. I think the biggest question, I think the biggest question is, how did it happen? How could the people sin after everything that they went through, where God takes them out of Egypt and saves them, and then saves them at the Yam Suf, saves them at the Reed Sea, and then takes them, and they have this whole journey to Har Sinai, and God gives them, and God speaks to them, and even if, according to the Midrash, he only spoke the first two commandments, but still included in there is, don't have any other gods. You know, I'm the one God, don't have any others. And here they are 40 days later, and Moses doesn't show up, and they can't hold on to themselves, and they're sinning, and they're dancing around this golden calf. And I think, you know, we have a difficult time relating to that. Although, it was actually an interesting story that took place in 2004. this is not a picture from there. This is just an image. But in 2004, in the city of Eilat, so there was a basically a hotel there in the desert. They have these parties where they're able to go into trances, and they play the music, and very exciting outdoor partying going on for young people. And in January of 2004, on the Sabbath, actually, hundreds of young people celebrating there and having a good time. They brought out this big golden calf and displayed it in the middle of all the wild dancing. And, there were two sort of different approaches. One approach was like, hey, yeah, we're just like we're just like the Jews at that time. And they danced around the golden calf, and here we are doing it again. And others who were there, on the Sabbath, and it wasn't, this wasn't their, they weren't religiously observant Jews in terms of the Sabbath, but they stood back and they were like, they couldn't believe it. Are you saying that you're making us look like we're Ovdei Avodah Zarah, like we're idol worshipers? And then sort of the approach of some of the individuals is what, I'm no longer a Jew just because, basically they rubbed their eyes in disbelief. They couldn't believe that this is what was going on. And so some people actually, after coming all the way from like places like Tel Aviv for many hours, they got in the car and they went home. They felt like this is, this is too much. We're not Jews. It struck them. It was just too strong. And there were a lot of protests to the organizers, and the organizers were sort of like, well, you desecrate the Sabbath, and all of a sudden you're traditional and you're observant. Like, if it's not appropriate, so don't stay. But many people didn't. They felt like this was too much. This was over the line. Most of us are not involved in this type of activity. And it's sort of hard for us to really relate to what this could possibly mean and how you could possibly have this story. So let's take a look at the story, the basic text from the Tanakh. I'll just read it in the English just for the sake of time and paraphrase it maybe even, right? So the people saw that Moshe was late from coming down from the mountain, and they gathered against Aaron and they said, let's make a God that will go before us, because we don't know what has become of this man, Moses. Aaron says, okay, take off your golden earrings that are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me. Takes all of them off. They bring them to Aaron, and he takes them with a fashioning tool, and he makes them into the egel azav, into the egel masecha, to this molten calf. And they people said, Eil Elohecha Yisrael, these are your gods. Israel, Shehalucha Meretz Yitzrayim, that took you up out of the land of Egypt. So Aaron sees this, he builds an altar, and he says, okay, tomorrow there's going to be a holiday. And then they get up early, they offer burnt offerings, and they sit down, they eat, they drink, and they got up to make merry. And the tzachek, oftentimes in the Bible, that means sexual activity. So we understand that they got up for sexual licentious behavior. That's the basic story, as we know it. It really takes place in these six verses in chapter 32. So there are two sort of basic approaches to understanding this story. Right? We're asking the question, how did the Jews do this? How did they get involved? How could this happen? So there's sort of two basic approaches. One is that of Rashi, and the other is that of the Ramban, which is also picked up by the Kuzari and Ibn Ezra. Rashi's approach is essentially, this is real idol worship, and this is what they wanted to do. There are multiple Rashis, but he says basically, we need gods who will go before us. you know, Moses directed us until now, but now we need gods. We need to have, we need idols. It was just pure, unadulterated idol worship. The Ramban and the others say, no. That's not what it was. It wasn't that they wanted to worship idols. No. The Ramban says, you know, he quotes Rashi and he says, nah, I don't think so. And here's why not. And he says, because what they wanted, look back at the verses. It's if you look back, right? So they saw that Moses was late and we don't have Moses. So what do you need? Moses, they knew Moses wasn't a god. Moses never claimed to be a god, and they didn't treat him like he was a god. They need a replacement, says the Ramban. Moses led us until now, and now we don't have him. We don't know where he is. And we need another Moses. So when we were talking about the golden calf, they were looking to have a replacement for Moses, somebody who would lead them in the desert, something that would guide them and give them direction. So that's sort of a different approach. It's not real unadulterated idol worship. It was they needed something to replace Moses. So these two approaches lead us to a bunch of questions. So questions, let's say, on Rashi. So Rashi says that, you know, it was unadulterated idol worship. So really the biggest question on Rashi is the original question that we asked. Why? How could they do that? They just heard the word of God 40 days before. And now all of a sudden they're just tossing out the window as, okay, let's go, let's do idol worship. Seems to be just, it doesn't seem to make sense. How could the same people who were given, you know, crowns by God, who according to the Midrash saw, you know, what prophets would later never see at the Yam Suf, at the Reed Sea, when the waters parted. They had prophecy and they went all these levels and they reached high and they heard God speak to them. The only time in history God speaks to a group of people out loud, and they heard it. And now all of a sudden they are debasing themselves with idol worship. That's sort of the question on Rashi. Then we got questions on the Ramban too. First of all, if the Ramban is saying, okay, what did they want? They wanted a replacement for Moshe. Moshe is the leader, is leading them. And, you know, so if they want a replacement for Moshe, did they really think that this golden calf is going to lead them like Moshe Rabbeinu? It just doesn't seem to make sense. We want an inanimate object. Moses is a leader, is a person walking, talking. We're going to have this inanimate object now is going to direct us. How is that possible? Well, how would that work? Why did they think that would work? Why would a golden calf be a replacement for Moses? And then a more basic question on the Ramban is, so now I'm asking you the question, all of you. Moses is gone. Okay, let's assume, right? First of all, we'll talk about that in a second. It seems to be like they forgot about Moses real quick. But you know, he said he was going to be 40 days. So this is okay. You know, this is a little late or whatever, but if let's say, let's agree that Moses is gone. So who would you want to be your leader? Who would you ask to be the leader in that case?
I am Aaron.
Yeah. No. What happened to Aaron? Moses and Aaron are always going to Pharaoh. Aaron is actually the real mouthpiece. Right. Moses says, I can't speak. I'm not good at this. It's not my thing. You know, Aaron is the speaker. Aaron is the one who uses his staff, does miracles. Like, no, forget Aaron. We want a golden calf to lead us. It just seems to be bizarre. Why would a golden calf be a good step in for Moses instead of Aaron? Aaron should have been the one. It was the obvious choice. And they ask him, right? They ask him to do stuff. They ask him to make the golden calf, and they have them do things, but they don't ask him to take over as the leadership. Doesn't seem to make sense. You know, he's the backup quarterback. So when the top quarterback goes down, so you go for the backup. You get the replacement, and the second string should come in. So that seems to be weird. And we got some questions on Moshe, right? Once we're asking questions, we get Rashi and Ramban, we're asking questions on the Rishonim. We'll go back and we'll ask questions on Moshe Rabbeinu too. What's my question on Moshe Rabbeinu? Why did he delay? Right? Why did Moshe delay? Meaning, it says in the Pasuk, right, it says that he delayed coming down. And we'll talk about that in a second. But why would he delay? Doesn't he know he's setting up the Jews? The Jews are fragile. They just came out of Egypt. They've been slaves. They've lived tough lives. And he told them he's going to be back at a certain time. And then he's not. And he's up the mountain with this God who makes, you know, lightning that you can hear and thunder that you can see and does scary things. And all of a sudden, Moses is gone. Why should he delay? That's one question on Moses. And the second question is on Moses. Why do you have to go away for so long? You know, it's difficult sitting there in the desert, you know, for 40 days. And then they're waiting for Moses. Why does he have to be away for so long? What is the purpose? What did he get? So he got the Torah in 40 days. Why 40 days? It seems to be a long time for him to go away. And the people are sitting there sweating, you know, in the desert. And then finally, I got questions on a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Got questions on God, too. The question on God is that...
No, it's dirty.
So we have the golden calf. And the golden calf, everybody agrees, golden calf, bad. Golden calf is not good. Everybody agrees to that. So what is the wrong with the golden calf? It's a representation. God says, you shall not have any representations of me. We don't do that. We don't have, images. We don't do that kind of thing. And yet, what did we just learn in the last two parashios, in Truma and Tetzaveh? Mm-hmm. All about a Mishkan.
Mishkan, a house,
a tent, a space for God, which is essentially a representation. It is a way for us to worship God. You know, the most troubling is actually if you get to the Holy of Holies, which nobody gets to go, or if you get to the Holy of Holies and what's in there, you know, you got the ark, and on top of the ark, you got these two angels. You got these two cherubs, whatever a cherub is, right? You've got these two of them on top of hugging each other, maybe, and looking at each other, and it's which again, no images. So how come the Mishkan is okay to have some kind of representation, some way to sort of see God, have a physical manifestation? Which, according to some, you know, we were supposed to have anyway. According to others, it's out of order, and it is a response to the golden calf. You made a golden calf. Okay, I see you can't handle it without some representation. I'm going to give you this representation instead. Well, why is that okay? So that's my questions on God. I have other questions for God, but meaning related to this issue. Okay, so let's go to sort of a basic answer to the Rashi question. Why did this happen? And this is not an answer. You know, I have two or three sort of approaches that I want to get into tonight in terms of trying to answer this question of how do we relate to the golden calf and how do we see it on a sort of a deeper level and have meaning for us. Here's though a different sort of basic answer, and that is that why did the Jews sin with the golden calf? Because they reverted to what they knew. They reverted to what they knew. All of this was very new to them. They've been living for hundreds of years under Egypt. an Egypt with lots of physical manifestations of multiple gods, and idolatry is the way things are done. This whole thing with a God that you can't see, who is a one God who controls everything, this whole thing is absolutely new. It sounds ridiculous. To us, it sounds normal because for so long, Christianity, Islam, all of the major parts of the world have already accepted this idea as basic. But at the time, this is a radical, new, bizarre idea, which makes a lot of sense that it's radical and bizarre because, if you see things in the world and there's good things happening and bad things happening and strange things happening and seemingly things that don't make that just seem to happen. So that makes a lot of sense that there are a lot of different powers. There's this God who does this and there's that God who does this and they're fighting. And that's why I understand why bad things happen and good things happen, as opposed to saying, no, there's one God. He's in charge of everything. Why do good things happen to rotten people and bad things happen to good people? Don't ask. God's in charge. He knows. And God knows exactly what she's doing. And it's all controlled. And don't worry about it. Well, that's not a very satisfying answer. So we understand why people look to something that makes more sense to them to say, okay, there are different powers in the world. So we have this language from Yechezkel, from the book of Ezekiel, which says that God sort of says, I told you to get rid of your gods, but no, they rebelled against me and they didn't listen. And they didn't get rid of the idols of Egypt. And I wanted to pour my anger out on them to destroy them because of, in the land of Egypt. So according to most, what is this talking about, this story in Yechezkel? Sounds like sort of, the idols, it sounds like it's talking about maybe the golden calf or something much later in history that takes place in Egypt. No, it's talking about, according to most, it's talking about something that took place in Egypt, meaning that the Jews themselves were worshiping idols, and God sort of is saying, you're supposed to know better. You're not supposed to do that. And you were worshiping idols in the land of Egypt before the Exodus. So basically, the reason why the Jews sinned is because they went back to what they knew. It's great that they've had 7 weeks now, since they left Egypt till they got the Torah, and another 40 days. So it's another 6 weeks or whatever. So and then maybe, there was a year worth of plagues or whatever. OK, but that's still a very short period of time. Their whole lives, they've been used to this idol worship being the way that you do things, the way that Egypt does things. So they revert when they get scared and when they have lost their leadership, they revert to what they know. So that's what they did. So that's sort of a basic answer to the question. But I don't know if it's and it may be a historical one. I don't know if it's really satisfying in terms of it's answering all of our questions, but it does. There's some truth to it there. Let's go back to the question about delaying. So did Moshe delay? So when we looked at the verse, it says, because Moshe delayed. Well, the famous Rashi, that they understood it wrong. The Jews got the, how to count the 40 days. The sunrise, the sunset, what did he mean? Is it 40 complete days or part days? So because of all the confusions, the Satan came and confused them even more and showed them image and it made it dark. Moses died and he fooled them. Okay, so that it's a nice midrash. And Rashi quotes it. But the simple meaning of the text is, Kiboshesh Moshe. Moshe was late, delayed. He was late. It's not good. And the truth is, if you look at the verse that comes before, right? So we looked. Let's go back and we'll look at the very beginning of the. So here are all the verses. All right, so chapter 32. they saw that Moses was late. Right, never good to be late. Me, I'm always 100% on time. Right, so those of you who are my congregants who are here are smiling and laughing because they know that that's not true. I try to be on time. That's the problem, is that you try to be on time, then you're always late. You know, you have to try to be 15 minutes early and then you're 5 minutes early. But, okay. So he was late. Now this is chapter 32. What I'm showing you now, jumping back to where we were. This is chapter 31, verse 18. It is the verse that comes right before chapter 32. So, Vayitan al Moshe kechalasol daberito b'har Sinai shnei luchos eidus luchos evan ksuvim ve'etzba elokim. So, he's given Moses already the two tablets. Moses has got them. And then we get these next six verses where that there's people that are having issues or whatever. Why didn't Moses just go down the mountain? Isn't he done? He's got the luchos. What's he waiting for? You know, Rabbi Kalman was talking about how we, you know, it's fun at the beginning of the, at the Zoom, because the time to schmooze and whatever. What's that? Moshe and God are schmoozing now? It's like kiddish time. They're just hanging out. He gave him the luchos. He could go, but let's just talk. Let's talk about stuff. And they do schmooze later. Unfortunately, they're schmoozing about the fact that the Jews have messed up. But why'd they mess up? Because Moses is up there. Send him down and be done already. And then if you look at the section right after what I showed you, Pasuk Zion, verse 7, right? It's almost like Vedavar Shel Moshe, God says to Moshe, Lech Rei, Kishikecha Amcha, Sher Halesa, Me'eretz Yitzrayim. Go now, go down, because the people you brought up, they've messed it up. Meaning almost it's like he was going to stay longer. You know, they were going to schmooze a little more. They had time to hang out, and God's like, no, sorry, you got to go down now. If you don't go down now, you know, it's going to be really bad. It's going to be really busted. You got to go before things turn ugly. So it's almost like indicative of the fact that Moshe was late. He was. And, which, you know, seems to be a strange thing. Why is Moshe late? So let's see if we can perhaps do a little more figuring out about that. So let's go back to Shemos 20. So that's Parshas Yisro, after the giving of the revelation. So we have the Ten Commandments. And we know part of the Ten Commandments are, right, God says, no gods of gold and silver. And then he's done. And we're finished with the Ten Commandments. And God says, Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Kosamar b'nei Yisrael, Atem Risam kimina shamayim dibarti mechem. You've seen that I've spoken to you from the heavens. By the way, lo sasuniti Elohei Chesef, Elohei Zav, lo sasulachem. By the way, right, don't make any gods of silver and gods of gold. Which seems to be strange. Why do we need this again? Why do we need God to tell us not to make gods of silver, gods of gold? He just said it in the Ten Commandments. Then he stops and says, okay, you see, I spoke to you. By the way, again, don't make gods of silver and gods of gold. So what exactly is that about? So again, looking back at the very first verse that I showed you from our story. So the people saw that Moses was delayed. Why'd they delayed? Why were they upset that he was delayed? So they said, you got to make gods that will go before us. Because, you know, Moshe was the one who went before us and we don't know what happened to him. So now we need to replace Moshe Rabbeinu. Rav E.T.L. Gold, in an article that he wrote, quotes Sigmund Freud's Totem and Taboo. It's actually, coincidentally, was part of a presentation at the Yarche Kala that Rabbi Kelman and I were at last week. This book was also quoted for a different reason. But in Totem and Taboo, Freud talks about, you know, sort of early peoples, and he talks about early the idea of idol worship, early pagan ideas, were what he calls the narcissistic state. Sort of, he sees it as a childish approach. And the approach is that, you know, the world is a strange place and lots of things happen that you can't understand and can't control. And that by creating and worshiping different deities, you sort of exercise a level of control because you have the god of fire, the god of water, the god of plants, the god of crops, the god of, you know, whatever it may be, the god of love, the god, this god, that god, and you appease them and you give things to them and you serve them. And by doing so, you can exercise a level of control. You can say, hey, I can make sure my crops are going to be good because I'm going to take care of this god. I can make sure that my children are going to be healthy because I'm going to take care of this god. You can control the things in your life that are bothering you, that you're worried about, with a sort of magical approach, which is that, you know, I will appease and I will do what I need to do to this god. And by doing so, I will make it that this god will help me. So I can sort of move the levers. I can serve, I can offer, I can do what I need to do in order to make sure that I will be able to control the gods to a certain degree so that they will serve me, that they will do what I need them to do. That's what Freud's idea was. And so here there was sort of a test of the Jewish people to say, hey, you know, we are, you know, in a situation where we've lost some control because Moses is supposed to be there and Moses is supposed to be in charge, but we take Moses out of the equation. So the people are a little bit unsure what to do, how to act. And the test is for them to realize, like, you know, there's a one God, and whether Moses is there or not, God will take care of us. And we are not completely in control. Moses doesn't show up when he's supposed to show up. And it's all right. Right? They're supposed to say, that's okay. We have trust. We have faith. Things are going to be all right. They fail the test. They fail the test. And they're not able to handle it. And they basically need to say, no, we need to exercise some control. We need to do something to make sure that we are going to be taken care of. So they're sort of lacking the faith in one God, in a God who, you know, you can't see, in a God who doesn't have any image, anything that you can look at in order to be able to feel like you can control this God. So all of that has been taken away, and the people fail the test. But to a certain degree, right, they are. They are learning from, you know, from this test, that really, God was there and God is still there. And, you know, the repentance that they do and the, sort of, makeup that they do for the golden calf allows them to see that there is another way to serve God without necessarily having the imminent, you know, vision of God right there and the control over God. And the question is, you know, so this is sort of the first approach, is are we still failing that test? Do we still feel like we want to make God in our image? Meaning, do we set the times to the Torah, or do we the other way around? Do we set the Torah to the times? Do we sort of say, look, I want to live a certain type of life, and I want to be who I am, and therefore I'm going to make God in my image. God is going to love whatever it is I do. You know, there's so many things in our modern day life that we can control. You know, used to be, you know, you want to look something up, you know, rabbi's giving the class. I think he said something wrong. I'll look it up on the internet. Okay, great. I can, right now I can tell you instantaneous information. And we've got smartphones and we've got smart homes that we can control with our smartphones. So we're not even home, but we can turn the air conditioning up and down and we can turn things on and off and the lights. And now we have ChatGPT. So we've artificial intelligence. We don't even have to think anymore. And there's so many things that we can control and we can do. And we just feel like we have incredible power. That we have the illusion that we can control everything. And therefore, we sort of feel like, you know, we're very powerful. You know, mankind, you know, maybe we don't have the power to create a new world, but we've managed to invent nuclear weapons and we feel like we could destroy a whole world. That's terrifying and frightening, but it's sort of like, you know, we have this power. You've got this God here, this totem, you know, holding onto this stick, all these things that we can do. And sort of, we feel like we're in control and we make God, in our own image. So that's something that we, you know, still are doing to some degree, to feeling like, you know, we have control and we can do whatever we want, because we really, you know, can control the levers. And sometimes also in our own, in our service to God, do we act that way? Feel like, you know, well, if we say a certain number of prayers, I say a certain number of Tehillim, so I can, you know, I can control how God's going to act. That also could be a facile way sometimes to approach God. Not to say that we shouldn't pray and not to say that we can't ask and all these things, but to say that we are in control, we can make God do what we want. That would still be, you know, sort of this approach to the golden calf. Let's take a look at a sort of a different approach. So, so again, I mentioned that at the very end of chapter 31, we have this verse that God gives the two tablets of testimony, the stone tablets written with the finger of God, right? So we've got the Luchos, and right away we see Moshe is late. What are we going to do? We're going to make gods. We're going to make gods. We're going to replace the, you know, Moshe with something else. Now, the chapters are somewhat artificial, right? Because the chapters aren't a Jewish invention. The chapters were put together in the 13th century by a bishop, and we did adopt them to some degree. But it doesn't, the way things are broken up is not necessarily by a chapter, is not necessarily part of the Jewish tradition, and it may not necessarily accurately represent how we would read the verses together in the Bible. So here you have, immediately after we're talking about the Luchos, right, we're talking about the tablets being created, right away we go into the replacement with the golden calf. Almost as if there's a connection between them. We see the same sort of thing. Moses comes down the mountain, right? He's carrying the tablets. And the ones that are written from both sides and inscribed, they're luchos are the act of God. They are charut al luchos, engraved on the tablets. Then Joshua hears the voice, and he says, "Oh, I hear what's going on." You know, there's the sort of the connection between the luchos and the golden calf. What does Moses do? Two verses later, when he sees the calf, he destroys the tablets. It's almost as if replacing the tablets with the golden calf, not Moses and the golden calf, but but the tablets in the golden calf. And in fact, what happens when it's all over and God forgives? Two new tablets. So when we're done with the golden calf and we've forgiven the people, fixed it up to a certain degree, then two new tablets right away. It's almost as to say that the connection between the golden calf and the tablets is very strong. Now, what's the difference between them? They're both made of very heavy material. The difference between them is imagery versus text. Meaning, the golden calf is an image. It represents something. It represents an animal. It represents something that we can see and feel and touch and hear. The luchos are pretty bland in terms of iconic imagery. It's just when they show them today, so it's got the Roman numerals, 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then it's the Roman numerals are there on the tablets. It's very boring. It's not such exciting. Even if we say, oh, well, it was engraved on both sides and that meant that some of the letters were hanging in place. So it was miraculous. But I mean, okay, it's not the same as a golden calf. It's just a tablet. But what it really means is that if you look, let's say in the book of Devarim, when it talks about the story, so what is it that the luchos are? The luchos are just the text, the written words. And that's emphasized here. Kol dvarim atem shomim. You hear the sound of words. Usmuna einchem roim zulasi. You don't know shape, nothing but a voice. And here at the end also, you saw no shape. God spoke to you. It's so strange and bizarre to them where they're used to God having an image that you can look at, even if it's just a representation. But now we're going to have ideas, words, sort of an intellectual, it's text, it's the mind. It's not so much about the body. And it's philosophy more than the physical. It's strange because in the ancient world, they're used to, you serve through the physical. Everything is physical. And here's a God who's about ideas. Not so much about images. Even though when we think about Judaism compared to, let's say, Christianity or even Islam, we have all these mitzvos and all these commandments and things we have to do. So we think of it being more physical than, it's not as much about creed. It's more about deed. But certainly it's not true that it's not about creed and it's not about belief. And it's about a God who you can't see and you can't touch and who shares with you ideas, who shares with you a philosophy, who shares with you a way of life, but it's not sharing with you an image, something you can bow down to. So the people were intimidated by this idea and they demanded an image instead. And instead of, if you think about it, the luchos, why did it have to take so long? Right? It took 40 days. Which is a long time, which really doesn't make so much sense because in Yisro talks about how the Ten Commandments are given, God gives them, right away. And then all of a sudden we get Parshas Mishpatim. Mishpatim is full of laws and all these details, whatever. Did it say Moses went up the mountain and got Mishpatim and came down? No, there's no talk about that. If anything, it's very possible that what took time was when Moses went up was more about the Mishkan, that he had to see the image of what it looked like and how it happened. So the people would like to have something that they can touch, they can feel, they can experience. And instead they're sitting there, for 40 days in a desert with no iPhones, no Nintendo, no Netflix. The eagle came instantaneously, right? He threw the gold in and it came right out. It almost giving the message, like it would be easy. The Torah is difficult. It's challenging. It's going to take time. There's going to be work involved.
as opposed to the idol comes easily, and it's something you can just get instantaneously right away. Even look at the language and the connection between, you know, here it says, he takes it from their hand and he, Vayatzar oso bacheret, says that Aaron, what'd he do? He had this verse before. He takes an engraving tool. It's a very rare word, this cheret word, only used like one other time in Tanakh, in Yeshayo. The engraving tool is a very strange thing. So what exactly is that meant to tell us? So if you take a look at verse 16, Valuchos Masa Elokim, the tablets were the work of God, Hemav Amichtav Michtav Elokim Hu Charut Aluchu. They was graven upon the tables. Now they're different spelled words. This is a tough, and up there is a test. But cheret and charut is so close. The alliteration, the sound, it's very interesting that there's this connection between the way that he made the calf and then the way that the writing of God was done on the tablets, right? That these are sort of interchanging one with another. And we have the same thing when you think about it in the language that's used as well when Moses is told to make the new tablets, in the famous verse, Ve'omer Hashem Moshe, Pisalacha, you shall hew for yourself. Again, what's the one of the words for idol that's famous in Tanakh? The Pesel. So it's Pesel and Pesel. And you should go and hew for yourself these tablets. And then there's the opposite of that. Is the idea of the idol. I think that the Rabbi Michael Hatton suggests that the idea here is that the Jewish people wanted something tangible that they could serve and didn't want the difficulties that come with a written Torah, with a Torah that's an idea, with a God who you can't see. And you can't feel. I mean, people always say that to me. Why can't we just see some miracles like in old days? Why can't we just see God? You know, if God would just come down and tell me, so then I would believe. It doesn't work that way. It's more complicated. It's something that we have to work hard to be able to accomplish. And we are used to, we want things instantaneously. We want things in the physical that we can see and touch and appreciate. And this idea that you're going to have a God who makes demands on you of an intellectual and spiritual nature that's going to require your hard work and your time and effort to study and to understand. And there'll be ambiguities and there's going to be doubts. And there's going to be challenges and you're going to have to work on it and you're going to have to argue and discuss instead of just sort of an easy, like here it is and take it. It's not what Judaism is. Judaism is not just, you know, here you are, here it is, and it's easy. It requires us to work at it. Of course, we believe that things we have to work at are of the greatest value, but that's a hard sell. It's not an easy sell. Through this, what was the biggest news in the Jewish world this past week? Biggest news? That's right. Heinz, kosher for Pesach, Heinz ketchup. Right? It's amazing. For me, this is big because, you know, I grew up my whole life and, Heinz was a very big part of it. I have a t-shirt my wife got me. I put ketchup on my ketchup. You know, cause like that's, and Pesach was 8 days without real ketchup. You know, I'm not even sure like if I can handle this. Like it just, there's something about Pesach where you have to have the bad ketchup. That's part of what my Pesach is. I don't even know I don't even know if I want to buy it. It's probably like $14 a bottle, but I don't even know like, you know, how I can handle this. What's my point? Is that even in the Jewish world where, you know, kashrut is supposed to teach us on some level restraint and can't have everything you want. And, you know, we have these cruises for Pesach where like, it's like and hotels and caterers, they make everything. So like, you can imagine it's not Pesach. The food is so amazing, and you've got this speaker and this kind of the swimming pool is made from crystal, and you've got all of the most amazing amenities and trips and fun. Everything's, we've become a very much a consumer nation and people. And to some degree, the latest things and appearances, we are buying into this idea that you have to have things, the consumer world around us, which makes that sort of, what your appearances and how you look and what you're sharing on social media. This is what's important, and this is what makes you into who you are. And that's becomes our new God. And we are, obsessed with the idea of sort of, quick fixes. If I have this, it's advertising. If you have this, then you'll be happy. And if you have that, then you'll be happy. And, when we look even at the frumest, Jewish magazines, it's full of all of these things that you can own and buy. And this is what's going to make you happy. This is what's going to make your Pesach. If you can have this and you can have that, you can have the kosher for Pesach Heinz ketchup, then you'll be happy. And of course, the Torah calls for a higher, more enlightened approach to life and to what we're supposed to be reaching for. And that's really, Elo Elohecha Yisrael, these are your gods. Sometimes is all of the superficial, materialistic things. And the Torah requires of us, not that we not enjoy life, that's certainly not part of the Torah, but if we make that the end all and be all, we're forgetting that Kadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, wants us to aspire for something higher, and not to take the superficial approach. So when you look in Shmos Chaf Daled, and God says, "V'yomer Shlomo Moshe, Alei Elai Har, come to the mountain, Ve'esham Ve'etnalachas Luchos Ha'Even. I'm going to give you these stone tablets, Ba'Torah, and the Torah and the Mitzvah Shekasavti, that I've written the Horasam, in order to instruct them." That we've been given this Torah, and that is our message. That is our reason as a people, and we should choose the intellectual and sometimes the more difficult over the easier and more concrete things that we can experience and see. So I'm mostly at the end of my time. So I want to open up if anybody has questions or thoughts or anything that you want to share. And if you have anything that you want to ask me about, if not, I could try to share one more idea very briefly. So, but I open it up to anyone now who wants to.
It's amazing that you just said the horot in Hebrew. How do we call parents?
Right, horim.
So what is the job of the horim? Is really to teach and to be example for the kids how to behave. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Fruchter.
All right. If you want to do a 5-minute, whatever, quick point, bevakasha.
Okay. So one more thought. So basically what I've presented until now is sort of two different approaches to understanding the golden calf in a way that relates to us today. Meaning the first being to sort of say that the idea that we can be in control, that we want to be in control. And the second idea was had to do with the fact that we tend to think about being able to have God be for us. We want to be able to have something that's easier to just grab onto immediately. We want to be able to have instant gratification as opposed to having to wait. Like there was the period of waiting that they had to do because they had to sort of learn, you know, what that would mean. You know, going back to the Mishkan and the idea of the Mishkan being that it's a place for service of God as opposed to a place of actually you know, having sort of God given to us as a package in terms of the idol. But one last idea that I want to share. Has to do with Aaron. The story of Aaron's approach, when we saw what Aaron said, what Aaron did, looks like Aaron fashioned the golden calf. So how do we understand what he tells Moses? He says, I told them if they have gold, they should give it to me. I threw it in the fire and well, this golden calf came out. Right? Makes it sound like, well, Aaron, you know, just pulled a fast one. We just read 20 verses earlier that he made it, but now he doesn't want to tell his brother that he made it. So he says, well, I threw it in and look what happened. Oh my God, I can't believe it. So the only thing is that understanding it sort of on that facile level, we don't understand how is it that Aaron is basically let off the hook for the most part for this sin. He doesn't get punished. He doesn't get killed when the Levites go out and Moses has them kill the 3,000 people who were involved in the idol worship. Aaron sort of gets a break. So the question is, you know, why is that? Why would Aaron get a break? So, again, with not having a lot of time, but I saw a really wild idea from Rabbi Yaakov Maidan. Yaakov Maidan suggests that really, you know, Aaron, what really happened was, you know, that Aaron did not fashion an idol per se. But what he did was he took the tool and he made little etchings in this gold. And he thought that he would destroy the idol and throw it into the fire. And by throwing into the fire, then he'd show the people, hey, this is not an idol. But instead, what happened was he made the etchings on it. He didn't form it. He made the etchings. That went into the fire. And what happened? The gold around the etchings fell off so that all that was left was the golden calf. So question is, why did Aaron do this at all? Why did he get involved in it? So what do we know about Aaron? We see this from Pirkei Avot, Hillel, Shammai, we know have different type of approaches. And Hillel was be peaceful, be from the students of Aaron, running after peace and loving peace, loving people and bringing them close to Torah. So what Maidan suggests is that the struggle here between Aaron and Moses is the classic argument between peace and truth. You know, and each of us sort of, we both of those are values that we both appreciate, that we all appreciate. But some of us go more towards the peace side. Some of us go more towards the truth side. And we always struggle with that because the truth is, even though they are both important values in Judaism, the highest values, they often come into conflict with each other. Does this dress make me look fat? There is a truthful answer and a peaceful answer to that question, but you can't have both. So how do you navigate that? And we know that Aaron was someone who ran after peace. And Aaron was trying to keep the Jewish people together. Basically, he was like, you know, just let me do something here. Give me the gold and let me push it off till tomorrow. And, you know, he was trying to find a way to keep everybody intact and not have to say, you know, you guys are off your rocker. We got to kill you. And, you know, that's it. Moses takes a very different approach. Moses, you know, when he comes down, he destroys the tablets right away. He succeeds in burning the golden calf, and he burns it right up and tosses it into the water. So on some level, Moshe was right in this situation. But the point is that Aaron, was not doing this out of, you know, this wasn't evil. This wasn't, something that was, absolutely wrong or bad. Aaron was, you know, it was a good approach. He made a mistake in terms of, you know, how to carry it out. And that struggle between truth and peace is one that we have to deal with every day. You know, when do we need to say, hey, this is wrong and what you're doing is wrong and you got to stop? And when do we not say anything? Right? When do we just sit on the sidelines? And that can be a big mistake too. Even though only 3,000 Jews, you know, were killed by the Levites for their involvement in this, but basically the whole people sort of sat on the side and watched it happen. And we know what happens when good people do nothing. So that sort of attention that Rabbi Meidan points out is perhaps what is at the root here. So I'm past my time already. I want to wish everyone a wonderful Shabbat. I want to thank you for joining me. I hope that this was enlightening to an issue that's always further bothered me. Like, you know, how does this relate to my life? And I think that in all three of these instances, they are ways that we can really think about how we approach, you know, some of the most basic ideas of Judaism, the way that we think about it in terms of understanding this very enigmatic story.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay.
Very enlightening.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. It was great getting to see everybody I could see and even just read the names of those who I couldn't see. And thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman, for having me.
Our pleasure. Thank you very much for joining. And okay, lots of truth and lots of peace. We need both Amen. Of them. And you might have Mashiach, right? That's, you know, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's line, Hamet Bashalom Ahavu, right? In Zechariah there, that's in Yimut HaMashiach, that peace and truth can be reconciled. But in this world, we can't really reconcile peace and truth, but we can try our best. Okay, thank you very much. My share tomorrow morning on the Siddur, 9:30 a.m. Everybody's welcome. Then, of course, Rabbi Liebtag at 11:15 on Sunday. And then our 5 shiurim that got canceled because the Purim last week, of course, we will be all back. Rachel Danziger, Sharansky, Shuli Mishkin, Mark Shapiro, Dr. Sokolow, and Rabbi Shulman will all be back. And then, of course, a regular shiur Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday next week, too. So we look forward to seeing you. We're putting the final touches on our Pesach program. We'll probably the middle of next week or so, you'll get all the details the week and a half or so before Pesach, a couple of weeks we'll have. Please, God, 10, 12 shiurim on Pesach, and everybody be well. Shabbat shalom. Are you an hour behind in Milwaukee? Are you in the central time zone?
We are an hour behind, yes.
Yeah, you're in the central time zone. Yeah, okay, that's what I thought. Okay.
We go to bed an hour earlier here, so we get up
an
hour.
We're changing the clock this week, so, you know. Right. We're all
going to lose an hour of sleep no matter where we are.
Arizona or something doesn't change the clock, isn't there?
Right, Arizona doesn't. And we're not going to soon. I don't know what. Yeah. What's the story in Canada that they're?
No, we change the clock except in Saskatchewan. They don't change the clock. But
they're next year,
8.5 Jews in Saskatchewan.
Next year in the United States, we're losing this. It's not,
no, Baruch Hashem. No. They agreed not to do that. Baruch Hashem. They were considering doing daylight saving time all year. I thought I'm very much against that. I like the changing clock, and it would have created
all kinds of dominion problems.
What time we would have davened in the morning in Toronto, Nates would be at 9 o'clock in the morning, you know, in the middle of the winter if they keep daylight saving time. So the Senate wanted that, but apparently it's not going through, which I don't know if people are following that. So we're going to have to spring forward and fall back next year too.
Thank God.
Okay. Anyways. Okay. Thank you very much. All the best. And Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Shabbat Hope to shalom. See you soon. And as always, please invite a friend to join. Okay. Bye bye.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shalom.
Chag Kosher v'Sameach.
Well, not quite yet, but soon. Okay, okay.
But yeah, and now, we have Heinz ketchup, like, whoa.
Heinz ketchup, we're at Pesach. Yeah. Okay.
Mahadran.
Yeah, it's,
okay. I'm wondering whether in Black Hat, Saskatchewan, there are any Jews.
I don't know. There are very few Jews in Saskatchewan. I don't even know how many shuls in Regina must have or Saskatoon. I don't really know. I mean, there are Jews in Winnipeg, of course. They have a pretty big community there. Vancouver, Edmonton, Calgary. But in Saskatchewan, I don't really know of much communities. I'm sure there are a few here and there. But anyway.
Are you in Toronto?
I'm in Toronto, yeah.
No, you're in Toronto. I'm from Toronto originally.
You're from Toronto, and where do you live now?
In Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Well, you're also in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, okay.
And I was about to say that with Rabbi Kalmar, you're going to be like catching up 1 hour. We're going to be 1 hour ahead of everybody because Rabbi Kalmar is in Milwaukee.
Okay.
When it's 8 o'clock there, it'll be 9 o'clock here because we're going to be ahead of everybody because of Rabbi Kalmar.
Okay, good to hear. Okay, but all right. Where did you live in Toronto? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up davening at Yevna Zion Congregation, where I was. I lane for my bar mitzvah was Bar Kore back in the early 70s.
Okay.
And davened when I could get out of laning, I would daven at Shomer Shabbos by Rabbi Felder's
Kol Rama. Sure.
Then my kids, who if you had any involvement with NTSY, my son-in-law Benjamin Pincus worked for Rabbi Black for 5 years.
I know the name, but I don't think I know him. But I know Rabbi Black, of course. Rabbi Black, I know, but
they were up at the Bayit.
So, yeah. Okay.
When Rabbi
I'm,
Tal was there.
I'm around the corner from Clanton Park.
And Clanton Park, and you daven at Clanton Park?
No, I daven at Or Chaim. I'm 3 blocks away from Or Chaim. That's where. I mean, I do occasionally in the summer or in the morning. But,
we're boring everybody.
No, this is afterwards. No one has to stay. This is just, you know, Jewish geography a little bit. But anyway.
I used to walk from my house, Bathurst and Lawrence, to Clanton Park. To hang out with Mark Frankel.
Oh, okay, sure. So I live on Dorchester. You walk to 9 Dorchester. I'm on 16 Dorchester.
And Frankel. Collins then by the grass scenes, that's down the street.
Yeah, so we live across the street. I mean, now the grandson's in the house, in the Frankel house. But, that's right. They grew up, I mean, we live on the street. Mary Frankel was living here when we moved into our house. Where we, if you know who the Ganses are, whatever, that's just us we bought. Gans, you know the Ganses?
Sure.
So that's where we're living. That's the house we bought.
Where did you move from?
Yeah, well, that's the first house we bought since when we got married. I mean, we lived in an apartment for a year and then we bought a house. So but I grew up Overbrook in Evanston, in Bathurst Manor.
Uh-huh.
Half an hour walk from where I am now.
Yeah. And we still have a lot of connections in Toronto, Baruch Hashem.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to get to work. Got to finish preparing my shiur for tomorrow. So, you know, going to get to work. Okay.
So what's the shiur on and how do you get on, how do we
you're
get
welcome to come. If you, it's the same login here. Did you sign up for the class? Did you register? If you sign up for
email. When I saw the Zoom, I didn't sign up. I just zoomed onto it.
Okay. So you know what? Send me your email. Go to Torah Motion website. I'll send you the information. It's at 9:30 on the sitter. So
9:30, which
I've been giving this year for a year and a half now, but right. 9:30, 8:30 in Milwaukee, 8:30 a.m. Friday morning in Milwaukee.
Okay.
I don't know if it's too early or too late for you.
Depends. If it's an 8 o'clock minute tomorrow. It depends.
Okay. It depends how fast they daven if they say tachanun or whatever. But okay. Anyways, that's, you can sign up for anything on the website, on our website. But okay.
I've got to figure that out first. You know, I'm not so posh.
Right. Well, just go to the website and or send an email to info@toronmotion.org.
Okay, and, very good.
I can I can add you to our mailing list, and then you'll get information for any class you want.
That's good.
Yeah, so go to info, I-N-F-O, of course, info, at Torah in Motion, one word, T-O-R-A-H, torahinmotion.org. Just send an email.
I get emails from you. So, and that's also the kids stuff in Torah in Motion, is it not?
I'm sorry?
Isn't a lot of children's material available in Torah in Motion?
I wouldn't say that. No, we're basically focused on adults. I wouldn't say too much for children.
There's another site that sounds very similar to that.
Could be another site. Yeah, I don't know. But if you send me an email, we'll add you on. Torah in Motion, one word, .org.
Good.
Here, I'll put it right here. I'll put it in the chat box so you see it. Give me one second. Right there.
There we go. Okay, good.
If you send it to them, then we'll...
Oh, Rabbi Kelman. You related to Rabbi Kelman?
My father. I love Shalom. Father, yes.
Who was at Beth Emet?
Yes.
Adam Gadol.
Thank you. Yes. Okay. That's all right. See, this is why we had to have the whole conversation just for this part.
Talmud of Rabbi Felder. He was a Talmud together with Rabbi Felder.
Yes, correct. Now, well, my uncle was together with Rabbi Felder. My father was a little bit younger, but Rabbi Felder taught my father Hilchot Tefillin. When Rabbi Felder came to Toronto, he lived in my parents' and my father's house. He lived in the house for a while, and he got smicha with my uncle, with Rabbi Price, under Rabbi Price. Rabbi Felder. And my father was a little bit younger, but I know Rabbi Felder, and my father was very close to Rabbi Felder. As a matter of fact, every year on Purim, my father would take me to Rabbi Felder and Rabbi Price for Shalach Manas.
Wow.
We'd go and he'd shmooze with Rabbi Price. Of course, in Yiddish, I didn't understand one word, but he would always take me, you know, meet his sort of Rebbe, you know, Rabbi Price on Two Prince Charles, you know, and go to Rabbi Felder. Sure. Yeah. So,
wow. We could have hours conversation.
There you go. Okay. But anyway, so please God, you'll come to some more of our classes and then we can, you know, we'll have time to schmooze.
Be well.
Okay. Laila Tov. Bye-bye.
Laila Tov.